This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the Sunday, August 2nd edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Craig Fife reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And we'll begin with the obituaries from the Sunday edition. And there is only one from the Sunday edition. Diane M. Korzynski, 75, of Natick, passed away peacefully on Monday, July 27th, following a brief illness. Relatives and friends are kindly invited to attend Diane's funeral on Wednesday, August 5th, that's tomorrow, beginning at 9 a.m. at the John Everett and Sons Funeral Home, 4 Park Street, Natick Common, followed by a funeral mass at 10 a.m. at St. Linus Church, 119 Hartford Street, Natick. Interment will follow at St. Patrick Cemetery in Natick. Visiting hours will be held at John Everett and Sons Funeral Home on Tuesday, August 4th, that's today, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. In lieu of flowers, donations in Diane's memory may be made to the Lupus Foundation of America, Incorporated, 2121 K Street, Northwest, Suite 200, Washington, D.C., 20037. Or you can visit www.lupus.org. For online guest book and directions, please visit www.everettfuneral.com. That's EVERETTFUNERAL. Couple settles eBay lawsuit. Agreements total nearly $56 million. This story is by Norman Miller, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. Nearly 6 years after several eBay employees were charged with harassing and terrorizing a Natick couple in retaliation for negative stories posted on the couple's e-commerce website, a federal lawsuit has been settled for more than $55 million. Ina Steiner and her husband, David Steiner, announced the settlement on Monday, July 27th on their website, E-Commerce Bytes, an online news publication and platform for e-commerce merchants and online auction sellers. David and I officially settled the lawsuit we filed in 2021 against eBay and its former executives over the stalking and harassment campaign we endured in 2019, designed to stop our reporting, Ina Steiner wrote. The landmark civil rights settlement includes $55.7 million in compensation and charitable commitments. Tuesday, July 28th, David Steiner told the Daily News that the harassment took a toll on every aspect of the couple's lives. I think the whole process, not just the stalking activity, but being involved in a criminal litigation and civil litigation, that leaves scars, he said. It's very difficult. It was emotionally, mentally, physically draining and damaging. It also had real impact on our finances. We've been reporting for 27 years now. I consider ourselves the foremost experts, especially Ina, in commerce. I would say if you Googled e-commerce bites before 2019, you'd have found links regarding e-commerce. Now it's primarily about the stalking. As part of the settlement, the Steiners will receive $48.7 million. $46.15 million from eBay, the online marketplace that uses both auctions and fixed price sales, $2 million from former eBay CEO David Wenig, $500,000 from former eBay executive Wendy Jones, and $50,000 from former eBay executive Steve Weimer. San Jose, California-based eBay, a publicly traded company that posted 2025 sales of $11.1 billion, will also donate $6 million to various charitable nonprofit organizations, and Wenig will donate $1 million to a charity dedicated to protecting First Amendment rights in the name of Ina Steiner. Also, eBay must issue a strongly worded public statement regarding the conduct of Wenig, Weimer, and Jones in connection with the Natick incidents and the company culture in 2019. David Steiner said the couple initially wanted to take the case to trial and force eBay executives to testify. However, he said eBay would likely have appealed the verdict after such a trial, thus extending the case for at least another 3 years, if not more. He said, with him being 67 and Ina being 64, they didn't want to fight this case into their 70s. "Frankly, we put on this battle for 7 years. It was time," David Steiner said. "You never get everything you want." The lawsuit does not contain any non-disclosure clauses, meaning the Steiners can speak publicly about the case. Their attorney, Christopher Murphy, said that was a key part of the settlement because it was important for the Steiners to let people know what happened to them. "Ina and David knew from day one what they wanted," Murphy said. "They wanted to know how this happened and why it happened to them. They wanted to hold those responsible accountable. They wanted to protect free speech, the First Amendment. They wanted to show that big business can't bully the little guy." David Steiner said that having a non-disclosure was non-negotiable for him and his wife. As journalists, they wanted everything out in the open, not kept quiet. In its statement, eBay called the actions in 2019 as wrong and reprehensible and condemned the employees who took part in the stalking and harassment of the Steiners. The company acknowledged the unprofessional tone of the former employees in emails. "We continue to extend our deepest apologies to the Steiners," the eBay statement reads. "This agreement is consistent with our commitment to fairly compensate the Steiners and fulfill our efforts to make things right." The harassment began in August 2019 after officials at eBay became angry with negative press posted on the Steiners' website. In particular, the lawsuit alleges that then-CEO Wenig became extremely angry and that James Bao, head of security for eBay, and several other employees began terrorizing the Steiners. The group conducted both an online and in-person campaign against the couple. It included mailing disturbing items such as a bloody pig mask to the couple's home, as well as live insects. They also sent pornographic magazines to neighbors, but with the Steiners' name on them. They sent a book about surviving the death of a spouse to their home. They also posted threatening and harassing messages on social media, as well as spread lies about the website and the couple. They followed the Steiners while they drove and considered breaking into their home and sending gang members to their home to scare them. In 2020, the couple reported incidents to the Natick police. After a joint local and federal investigation, the conspirators were arrested in June 2020. Wenig was never criminally charged and denied the allegations, but Bao and six others were each convicted in federal court for their roles in the harassment campaign. The company itself was also criminally charged in federal court. It entered into what is called a deferred prosecution agreement with the Federal Department of Justice and agreed to pay the maximum criminal fine of $3 million and to take corrective action with its policies. Murphy credits the Steiners for not giving up. Ina and David have a lot of grit and guts, he said. They did a great job of documenting what happened, preserving evidence, and sharing it with law enforcement and going through the criminal court system as victims and then through the civil system. I hope this brings them some closure. David Steiner said he and his wife are just glad the case is over. I look forward to having, with whatever time I have left on this planet, fun with life, doing the things we enjoy to do, he said. I think we accomplished a lot. Bill would make two-family zoning the norm. This story is by Margie Cullen, USA Today Network, New England. The Massachusetts Senate, July 23rd, passed a measure it hopes will create unprecedented levels of new housing in Massachusetts. The legislation included in the Senate's sweeping economic development bill would apply automatic two-family zoning across Massachusetts, allowing duplexes to be built on most residential properties. Senate President Karen Spilka, Democrat Ashland, said in a statement that the measure will provide opportunities for new families to find a home they can afford. Senator Michael Rodriguez, Democrat Westport, said it will spur housing development. Housing advocates say this measure could help tackle the state's housing crisis. Under the current law, only one-third of the state's land allows duplex by right, Abundant Housing Massachusetts said in a press release. This solution could unlock thousands of new homes to address our housing affordability crisis. As the Senate Economic Development Bill is different from the House's, the two chambers must come to an agreement in conference committees before it goes to Governor Maura T. Healey's desk. How does the bill make two-family zoning automatic? The bill would effectively end single-family zoning by allowing duplexes to be built on most residential zones. No zoning ordinance or bylaw shall prohibit, unreasonably restrict, or require a special permit or other discretionary zoning approval for the use of land or structures for a single duplex on lots zoned for residential use, the bill reads. There are some restrictions. Municipalities can set standards for height and design, and properties that need septic systems can be exempt. But standards cannot be unreasonably restrictive. A local regulation, ordinance, or bylaw shall not be more restrictive of duplexes than of single-family dwellings, and shall not individually or cumulatively render the development of a duplex physically or financially infeasible, the bill says. Regulations are only allowed if they address a specific, articulable concern that cannot be addressed by less restrictive means. Massachusetts is in a housing crisis, according to the state government's website, with some of the highest home prices in the country. A June poll from the University of New Hampshire Survey Center found a majority of Massachusetts residents believe housing or the cost of living is the most important problem facing the state. A July poll from the same center found that one-third of residents said they are likely to leave the state within the next 5 years, largely because of the cost of housing and living. On top of other statewide efforts, including a ballot question that aims to make more affordable starter homes, the bill takes other steps to combat the problem. It also authorizes $2.5 million for a pilot program that helps construct permanently affordable home ownership units, or units with low and moderate income households. And now let's take a short break.
Would you like to hear news from Clinton, Lancaster, Boylston, and West Boylston that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Tuesday at 3 p.m.
Are you having difficulty with your eyesight? Are you losing your vision? Are you afraid of what comes next? If you're blind or visually impaired, contact Mass Commission for the Blind to find out if you're eligible to register for services. Learn new skills to reclaim your independence. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 15 minutes past the hour. French-themed bakery rises to meet demand. This story is by Joanna K. Tsouvelis, Wicked Local, USA Today Network. Just a year and a half after opening its bakery in Wellesley, Le Petit Four has taken another major step. Le Petit has opened a 7,500-square-foot production facility at 110 Gould Street in Needham. The factory handles all preparation for the bakeries, pastries, breads, and other menu items, freeing up space in Wellesley while also creating capacity for wholesale business, catering orders, and future expansions. "We outgrew the kitchen quite quickly," said Romain Bernu, who runs the business alongside his mother and founder, Valérie Coulet. "Within 4 or 5 months, we realized, okay, I think this is going to be a problem. Rather than duplicate kitchens and staff at every future location, Bernu and Coulet chose to centralize production in Needham." "Both my mom and I were on the same page," Bernu said, "recreating an entire team, given how hard it is to find good people. We can't do that. We can put all of our efforts into one main place with good people where my mom can be, where I can go, where our head chef, Michelle, can go, and really make sure quality is always top-notch." Needham was a natural fit. The bakery's Wellesley property manager owns the Needham building, and Bernu and Coulet each live there as well. Bernu oversaw the expansion project once the lease was signed in September 2025. "For me to be the project manager and be on-site every day really helped us think of the future," he said. "It ended up being exactly what we wanted." The production facility includes larger freezers, specialized production areas, and a walk-in oven. Bernu said the expanded space has improved efficiency and consistency. "At the end of the day, why do we go through all this?" he asked. "It's just to have consistency and good quality. Today, all doughs, fillings, and other preparations are made in Needham before being delivered to Wellesley for baking. Separating production from baking has improved quality," Bernu said, "especially for delicate viennoiserie items such as croissants that require temperature-controlled conditions. Being able to separate the baking versus the prepping is actually huge in terms of keeping the quality or even making it better," he said. The expansion was expensive, but largely self-funded. "We're just happy we don't have any big corporation or anyone else that owns it," Bernu said. The Needham factory allows Le Petit Four to welcome wholesale customers. The company has signed its first wholesale account and is pursuing partnerships with independent coffee shops. Bernu said large chains are not part of the plan. "We owe it to everyone and to ourselves to do quality baked goods," he said. "When you start producing on that level, especially for companies that want products to last days or a week, it's not really our brand. Our stuff is something you come and eat the same day." Bernu said the factory is critical to the business's long-term goal of opening two additional Massachusetts bakeries. The team is actively working on a second bakery that could open next spring. I think this gets us from being one local bakery to three, Bernice said. Three is kind of the golden number for us. Maintaining Le Petit Four's authentic French identity remains the priority. Coulet has shifted from day-to-day production to focusing on training staff, maintaining standards, and developing new products after trips to France to learn from top pastry chefs. In 5 years, Bernie hopes the company will have three thriving bakeries while preserving the quality that built its reputation. And while the business has grown rapidly from its origins as a home kitchen, he said the teams still take pride in hearing customers compare their pastries to those found in France. One customer review, he said, perfectly captures what Le Petit Four strives to be, a trip to Paris in a bakery box. A lot of our customers come back and say, "We went to Paris, and honestly, we couldn't wait to have your croissants again," Bernie said. People think quality. They think, "Wow, I don't even have to travel to Paris to have the exact same quality." Massachusetts candidates have raised $26.3 million in 2026. This story is by Margie Cullen, USA Today Network, New England. Massachusetts candidates running for office this fall have raised over $26.3 million in the first half of 2026, according to data from the Office of Campaign and Political Finance. That number includes money raised by most candidates running for state and county positions in Massachusetts, but not for federal offices like U.S. Senate or House. It also doesn't include county races, such as commissioner or special election for sheriff. Candidates report spending $15 million, a press release said. Over half that money comes from the governor's race, and over $10 million comes from a single candidate. Here's a breakdown of how much Massachusetts candidates have spent and raised this year. More than half of the total fundraising and spending by Massachusetts candidates was done by the 11 candidates running for statewide offices, including for governor, attorney general, and state treasurer. They have raised over $16.6 million and spent over $8.3 million combined. The governor's race, in which two Republicans are challenging Governor Maura Healey, accounts for the vast majority of that, with candidates having raised $14.4 million and spent $8.3 million total. Here's about how much all the statewide candidates have raised this year, according to OCPF data. For governor, Governor Maura Healey, Democrat, $2.6 million. Michael Minogue, Republican, $10.4 million. Brian Shortsleeve, Republican, $1.1 million. Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, Democrat, $1 million. Sean Oliver, Republican, $106,143. Attorney General Andrea Campbell, Democrat, $534,134. Michael Walsh, Republican, $51,515. Secretary of State William Galvin, Democrat, $121,062. Treasurer Deb Goldberg, Democrat, $144,708. Elizabeth Dionne, Republican, $202,658. Auditor Diana DiZoglio, Democrat, $92,454. House and Senate. There are 308 candidates for State House and Senate this year who have in total raised about $7.7 million and spent $5.8 million. Senate candidates account for most of the money. On average, Senate candidates have raised $45,975 and spent $36,452. House candidates, on average, raised $19,446 and spent $14,061. District Attorney. There are 23 candidates running for 11 district attorney seats, including 8 candidates running for Norfolk County District Attorney. In total, they have raised about $1.45 million and have spent $666,196. Register of Probate. The 16 candidates running for 14 Register of Probate seats have raised $222,167 and spent $107,347 in total. Governor's Council candidates have raised $223,928 and spent $79,563. 6 of 8 seats are contested, with a 14 candidates total. Police say clerk stole up to $40,000 in scratch tickets. This story is by Norman Miller, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. An employee is accused of stealing thousands of dollars worth of scratch tickets from a Sudbury grocery store and cashing in the winners, police said Wednesday, July 29th. Sudbury police arrested Marcos Dalbano da Silva, 38, of Marlboro, at 4:08 p.m. Tuesday, police spokesman Lieutenant John Perido said Wednesday. Da Silva was an employee at Stony Brook Market and Liquor, 29 Hudson Road. One of the employees was described by a manager over the past few months as taking scratch tickets, Perido said. They are estimated upwards of $40,000 worth of scratch tickets. An employee at the store said they could not comment. They referred all questions to a manager who could not be reached for comment. Da Silva allegedly stole at least $10,000 worth of scratch tickets, Perido said. But he said that that number would likely rise after a full audit is complete. The lieutenant said Da Silva would scan the tickets to see if they were winners. He would then apparently throw the losing tickets away and cash in the winners. It's not known whether tickets were cashed in at Stony Brook Market or some other store. Perido said it appeared Da Silva won $1,000 to $2,000. This is still an ongoing investigation, the lieutenant said. There's a lot of auditing that has to be done. Police charged Da Silva with one count of larceny of more than $1,200 by a single scheme. Da Silva pleaded not guilty Wednesday during his arraignment in Framingham District Court. His court-appointed lawyer, Christine Breslin, could not immediately be reached for comment. Judge Jennifer Queeley released Da Silva without bail, ordering him to stay away from the store. Da Silva is due back in court on September 24th for a pretrial conference. And now let's take a short break.
Would you like to hear news from Fitchburg and Leominster that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Wednesday at 4 p.m.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 29 minutes past the hour, almost 30 minutes past the hour. Retired Teacher Penn's Third Novel. This story is by Beth McDermott, Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. This story was created with the assistance of artificial intelligence. A retired Natick teacher recently published his third novel, Slider, which draws inspiration from decades of Massachusetts baseball memories and a lifelong connection to the state. Peter Alderman taught for 37 years at the Bennett Hemingway Elementary School and Wilson Middle School before becoming a writer, according to a community announcement. He and his wife, Pam, raised their three sons in Holliston. Now living in Franklin, Tennessee, Alderman is near his sons, Chris, Sean, and Jason, their families, and seven grandsons. But he has ties to Massachusetts. But his ties to Massachusetts continue to influence his work, according to the announcement. Slider, which was released last fall, combines baseball and suspense, tracing a path familiar to New England fans, according to the announcement. Summers spent on Cape Cod, Cape League games, and following the Boston Red Sox helped inspire the story. Alderman also drew inspiration from Holliston native Mark Sweeney's baseball journey from high school to the University of Maine, the Cape League, and Major League Baseball. The novel's title came from a conversation with a coach at one of his grandson's baseball games, according to the announcement. A slider, a breaking pitch known for its late movement, caught Alderman's attention and ultimately became the name of the book. Slider opens at Yankee Stadium before taking readers through several Massachusetts locations. The story weaves together suspense, history, and local settings, including North Adams, Cape Cod, Fenway Park, and Boston. According to the announcement, the novel features colorful characters, unexpected twists, and a tale of retribution that builds towards a surprise ending. Boston-based burrito chain Boloco to close last eatery. This story is by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, U.S. New England. Boloco, a Boston-based chain known for its burritos, wraps, and bowls, announced it will close its last restaurant. The remaining location at 50 Congress Street in Boston's financial district will shutter in early fall, the company said in a Facebook post this week. The chain has been open for 29 years and was once a lunchtime fixture for downtown Boston office workers. It's been a hell of a ride, Boloco said in the statement. The fast casual chain attributed its closure to the building's conversion to a residential complex. In May, the Boston Planning and Development Agency Board approved plans to convert the 50 Congress Street office building into 169 apartment units, including 34 income-restricted units, as part of the city's office to residential conversion program. The project will also include about 7,372 square feet of commercial space on the ground floor, potentially consisting of restaurant or similar neighborhoods serving use, according to the plans. Boloco was founded as Under Wraps in 1997, across from Berklee College of Music, according to its website. Later renamed Boloco, short for Boston Local Company, the chain eventually grew to 22 locations across Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. in the mid-2010s. By 2020, the company had dwindled to about 8 locations, the website said. Boloco's penultimate remaining restaurant at Boston Children's Hospital closed August 2025. In a February blog post marking the chain's 29th anniversary, co-founder John Pepper wrote that with the COVID-19 pandemic came a relentless series of closures for the company. He said, however, that the remaining location at 50 Congress Street was staffed with passionate team members who want to be there, and he enjoyed working on the store upgrades and installations. 29 years, still here, still grateful. 30 will be a stretch, but we've come this far. It's not unlikely, also not guaranteed. We squeeze another year out of this thing, Pepper wrote in the post. The last Boloco location is set to close Friday, September 25th, the company said in a Facebook post. Every day until then, open or closed, you can expect any number of not-so-clever reasons to come back one more time. A story you can't make up. An old favorite makes a final appearance. Free burrito day. Special requests, the company said in its post. Neither Boloco nor the building's listed developer, Mahoney Development Group, LLC, immediately responded to requests for comment. Senators introduce Social Security fix. This story is by Medora Lee, USA Today Network. Social Security is facing across-the-board benefit cuts in 6 years, and older Americans want solutions, not opaquely operating committees, the AARP said. A bipartisan group of senators has introduced legislation to fast-track any Social Security savings bills that could shore up the dwindling trust fund that supplements payroll taxes and keep benefits 100% intact. A bipartisan 7-member Social Security Advisory Board would draft a bill to keep the program's trust fund solvent for at least the next half century. The Protecting Retirement Opportunities and Maintaining Income Security for Everyone Act would then be introduced in the House and Senate by congressional leaders before being considered by committees, which would hold hearings and revise the legislation. Some prominent think tanks, such as the Bipartisan Policy Center and the Committee for a Reasonable Federal Budget, support the move to jumpstart talks to keep Social Security solvent. The BPC endorsed the proposed legislation as a serious bipartisan process to break the status quo of inaction. The CRFB said it hoped the proposal jumpstarts a much-needed process to secure Social Security. The AARP strongly opposes the bill, however. The nonprofit Nonpartisan advocate for 125 million Americans age 50 and up said Congress urgently needs to address Social Security's finances, but there's no reason for lawmakers to farm out that work to another body as it would in the Promise Act. We strongly object to fast-tracking Social Security changes through Congress, AARP Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer Nancy Lee Mond wrote in a July 21st letter addressed to Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois, and Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican, Louisiana. Durbin and Cassidy are among the lawmakers who introduced the Promise Act proposal. The Promise Act would create an independent, bipartisan Social Security Advisory Board to develop and send a base bill to Congress that would ensure the Social Security Trust Funds have enough money for at least 50 years. Majority leaders of the state and the House, or if not, any members of Congress, could introduce the base bill, which would then be referred to the Senate Finance Committee and House Ways and Means Committee for a chance to hold hearings and amend it. The committees would vote or report on the base bill. If they don't, the bill would automatically be placed on the Senate and House calendars. The majority leaders of the Senate and House could move the bill forward, as they could any other member of Congress. As could any other member of Congress. Similarly, anyone in Congress could offer amendments after the motion to proceed. Finally, the Senate and House would vote on the bill after 100 hours of consideration. Final passage would require a 3/5 vote in the Senate and a majority vote in the House. Our bipartisan proposal opens Congress to debate this issue in a transparent, fair, and bipartisan way, Durbin said in a release. We were elected to solve problems, and there's no greater problem than the solvency and future of Social Security. Though Durbin touts transparency, the AARP said the bill offers the opposite. It said the Promise Act limits debate and amendments, and that could allow lawmakers to cut Social Security payments. Strengthening Social Security should happen through regular order in full public view with openness and transparency, rather than through a process that limits the type of amendments and sets arbitrary procedural deadlines to short-circuit the debate, Lamond said. The bill calls for the advisory board's proposal to be introduced in Congress by September 17th, or the first day after that when the House and Senate are in session, she said. Lawmakers could then hold hearings and amend the advisory board's plan, but would not need to vote to advance the measure out of key congressional committees, as is typical for federal legislation. Instead, if lawmakers don't vote by November 9th, the bill would move straight to the House and Senate floors during a post-election lame duck session of Congress, when departing members are completely unaccountable to voters, Lamond said. Among her other objections to the bill, she argues that it caps the time to consider, amend, and debate the bill at 100 hours and includes language that limits the types of amendments allowed. If every other bill in Congress goes through regular order, why would something as important as Social Security get special process that cuts off debate, that limits the kinds of amendments that limits the kind of things you can talk about, said Bill Sweeney, AARP Senior Vice President for Government Affairs. To us, this just doesn't make sense. The AARP also said it opposes two other bills that would create commissions to address Social Security's long-term solvency. One House bill, sponsored by Representatives Tom Cole, Republican, Oklahoma, and Tom Suozzi, Democrat, New York, creates a 13-member commission tasked with providing recommendations and legislation to Congress on how to shore up Social Security's finances. That bill would allow a proposed plan to move forward on an expedited up or down vote. Individual members of Congress would not be able to offer amendments, the AARP said. Another proposal would create a fiscal commission to reduce the national debt and annual deficits and shore up trust funds dedicated not just for Social Security, but also for Medicare and the nation's highways. But Social Security is a self-financed system that does not contribute a penny to the national debt, and Congress should not put it in the crosshairs of unrelated budget debates, Lamond said. Instead, any changes to Social Security should focus on the financial and retirement security of the American people. Social Security provides retirement benefits to 71 million Americans to give them some financial security. It's a promise that after a lifetime of hard work, you will receive the money you earned, Lamond said. Keeping that promise is one of Congress's most solemn responsibilities. If regular order is the gold standard for routine legislative matters, It certainly should be the standard for something as important as Social Security. And now let's take a short break.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 45 minutes past the hour. Soil moisture could predict wildfires. Data may help pinpoint where future fires strike. This story is by Sarah Henry, Arizona Republic, USA Today Network. The next evolution in catastrophic wildfire prevention is buried near the banks of the Salt River near Mesa, Arizona, where a host of battery-run sensors are tracking a measurement that's become one of the most important indicators of where wildfires will occur. That clue is hidden in the soil almost 2 feet underground. Over the last decade, researchers have studied the link between wildfire risk and a little-known index, soil moisture levels. Soil moisture can help them anticipate the severity and location of a fire. Soil moisture seems to be this kind of underrepresented component of how we quantify wildfire danger during fire season, said Zachary Holden, a research ecologist at the U.S. Forest Service. Excuse me. Excuse me. But that's changing. In Arizona, researchers are partnering with a biotechnology company and a utility to install soil moisture probes in saguaro and ponderosa pine forests. What used to be a time-consuming and labor-intensive process is now automated and can be rolled out on a larger scale, providing a better map of ignition risk and how wildfires might spread. Arizona isn't alone. Researchers at Oklahoma State University and the University of Oklahoma have incorporated soil moisture sensors into their world-class MesaNet, a network of environmental monitoring sites across the state. And in the Northern Rockies, ecologists, including Holden, are creating wildfire forecasting models using soil measurements. Drought, climate change, and decades of fire suppression have complicated wildfire response across the region. Real-time measurements can help land managers make quick decisions about warnings, closures, and strategy, all of which could help adapt to a drier, more fire-prone West. In the Tonto National Forest, underground soil moisture sensors connect to electronic black boxes that transmit information to a real-time dashboard. "We are measuring the soil because that's where the water is coming from to feed the plants," said Brian Henderson, CEO of Grovera, a biotech company partnering with the Northern Arizona University and Salt River Project on the initiative. "For wildfire risk, what we really care about is how much water content is in the fuel." In wildfire lingo, fuel means whatever plant material is available to burn, like sticks or shrubs. When the water content in the soil is low, likely so is the water content in the plants growing in that soil, which can result in more volatile fires, said Barry Johnson, a wildfire mitigation specialist at SRP. Usually, fire managers rely on weather station data like temperature, humidity, and wind to help inform their understanding of fire risk at a particular location. But what the weather can tell us is limited and broad, said Sally Diamond, an associate professor in the School of Forestry at NAU. Soil moisture data helps complete the puzzle, giving an early idea of just how dry fuels might be at a particular site. As a power company, we're looking to get indices, Johnson said. We want to know the live and dead fuel moisture because we want to be able to predict how wildfire is going to spread and how catastrophic it's going to be. When extreme fire conditions align, like dry weather and strong winds, utilities cut power in affected areas to help prevent sparks. Immediate soil moisture data can provide a hyperlocal picture of risk that could help utilities to better respond during emergencies. We want to try to keep the power on, Johnson said. That's our job. Fire is a natural component in most of our landscapes, Holden said. The ponderosa and conifer forests of northern Arizona burned at regular intervals for centuries, but decades of fire suppression and drought have made wildfires more severe. These days, land managers use prescribed burns to mimic that natural pattern and sometimes manage active wildfires to reap environmental benefits. But drought and climate change complicate matters. When managing a burn, fire officials pay close attention to weather conditions, which can suddenly change and turn a controlled burn into something more unpredictable. Soil moisture sensors could provide on-the-ground information for both prescribed burns and active wildfires. Even when a fire is burning, the soil sensors transmit information that can reveal how the wildfire is changing conditions in real time. That kind of immediate data could help fire managers decide whether to manage a burn or to suppress it if the risk is too great. In the Southwest, if we want to restore natural fire regimes that are lower intensity surface fires that are easier to manage, we need some component of naturally occurring fire, Holden said. The key component of this is going to be understanding the effects of longer-term drought on the soil moisture conditions in addition to surface fuels. The footprint of that wildfire goes beyond its immediate effects. The aftermath can destabilize a burned area for years, increasing the risk for another kind of natural disaster, flooding. Soil that's been scarred by fire can become hydrophobic, and when a waxy substance from burned plant material melts and congeals over its top layer, Diamond said, depending on the severity of the fire, the soil will repel water during rainy storms to greater or lesser degree. But ultimately, that means less water is absorbed by the earth, leading to more runoff that can culminate in flash floods. In the wake of the Pocket Fire near Sedona, Arizona, monsoon storms inundated parts of Oak Creek Canyon with mud and ash flows in July. Where tree canopies burned away and soil scarred, U.S. Forest Service officials expected a heightened flood risk for years to come. Soil moisture monitors could help land managers more accurately predict which fire-scarred regions are most vulnerable to flooding. They can also provide insight into how the soil is healing. School AI program paused after backlash. This story is by Emily Barnes, U.S. New York State Team, USA Today Network. A union representing New York educators is calling for statewide safeguards against the use of artificial intelligence in schools after a district announced their involvement in a pilot program that includes a humanoid robot's presence in a classroom. Excitement over Salamanca City School District's recent partnership with Realbotics, a developer of humanoid robots and advanced AI systems, revealed earlier in July, quickly waned as the decision made by the Western New York District was immediately met with a firestorm of criticism by parents, educators, and others throughout the state. Both district and company insist the program is safe, but others aren't too sure. And while the district's involvement in the program is now on hold, New York State United Teachers President Belinda Pearson wants state officials to do more to protect students and teachers alike. And that's about all the time we have for this news broadcast. You have been listening to a reading of the Metro West Daily News for Sunday, August 2nd, 2026. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or Braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to our Audio Journal website, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Craig Fife, and I thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
This is Bird Note. Today is International Owl Awareness Day. Owls are magnificent animals that share our cities with us, like great horned owls, and live in some of the most extreme environments on Earth, like snowy owls on the Arctic tundra. They range in size from huge, like the Blakiston's fish owl of Eastern Asia, to the songbird-sized elf owl of Mexico and the Southwest U.S., less than 6 inches tall and weighing less than half a deck of cards. Owls play key roles in their ecosystems. They keep prey populations of rodents and insects in check, which in turn helps promote a healthy balance of the species eaten by those animals. Owls even help control pests like non-native rodents where people live, all without traps or poison. And they lend their music to our nights. By giving these amazing birds their space when they're nesting, preserving habitats where they breed and hunt, and avoiding rodenticides that could poison their prey, we can help ensure a safe future for our world's incredible owls. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You are listening to Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thanks for listening. We have more programming coming up next.